What is Wharton looking for? What about its new deferred admissions programs? Most importantly, what do you need to do to get in? Why do you have to go through all those different steps in the application process? If those questions are residing in your head, listen in. Wharton's Director of Admissions, Blair Mannix, is our guest today. Welcome to the 342nd episode of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in," and not only in, but in at the best program for you. Before I dive into today's interview, I want to mention that today's podcast is all about the Wharton MBA program, and we'll be talking to Wharton's Director of Admissions. However, if you would like to hear my perspective on how to get into Wharton, in addition to today's guests, please watch the recording of Get Accepted to Wharton. Yikes, Wharton's round two deadline is looming. It's January 7th. You can still access the advice in this webinar in time to help you with your Wharton application. It provides a framework that you can use with any top MBA program, but the focus in this webinar is strictly on acceptance at Wharton's MBA program. View it at accept.com/342webinar. It gives me great pleasure to have on Admissions Straight Talk for the first time, Blair Mannix, Director of Admissions for the Wharton MBA program. Blair first came to Penn as a graduate student, where she earned her master's in higher education management in 2010. She joined Penn's undergrad admissions staff in 2008. She's been at Wharton since 2012 and became Director of Admissions just about 1 year ago. Blair, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Now, let's start with something really basic. Can you give me a brief overview of the Wharton MBA program with a focus on its more distinctive elements?
Right. So, you know, when I was thinking about the most distinctive elements of Wharton, I think the first thing that popped to my mind is Philadelphia. You can kind of see Philadelphia in the backdrop here. Sometimes I feel like I work for the Board of Tourism of Philadelphia. So I would say absolutely, Philly is the first, and I would argue the most important differentiator of the Wharton MBA program. The ecosystem, the culture, the atmosphere of Philly. It's very difficult to have a Wharton experience without having a Philadelphia experience, and very difficult to have a Philadelphia experience when you're at Wharton. So I think that's sometimes something that students don't realize, and it's absolutely a surprise. The second thing I would say, kind of element of the Wharton MBA program that I want to call attention to, is the way we teach. You know, fundamentally at its core, you know, Wharton MBA program is a school, and we feel really proudly in the way that we approach the teaching of business. And the idea that we understand there's too much academic research out there that just talks about how students fundamentally learn differently than one another. And so we like to provide content in a variety of different ways. And so you'll come in and take case classes, of course, but also lecture and simulation. We're very big on rolling our sleeves up in terms of teaching here at Wharton.
Okay, great. One of the things that struck me, I was at the AGAC conference. Well, as I mentioned to you before, I saw you at the AGAC conference in San Francisco, but I also was at the AGAC conference that was in Philadelphia several years ago. And one thing that has consistently struck me about Wharton is just the breadth of opportunity that Wharton provides. Right. And the commitment of the Wharton staff to kind of helping students take advantage of that breadth and navigate it, because there's just so much right. opportunity. But anyway, that's me editorializing. Let's get back to you. You know much more.
No, I'm just consistently surprised, and not surprised, just impressed by my colleagues' commitment to students. I would say, honestly, more than 90% of meetings I'm in, kind of at the divisional level, Linda, are about how we can support students, about how we structure curriculum to support students, how we work with career management to support students, how we do student life to support students. And, you know, we say jokingly and then sometimes kind of serious that, you know, you are not going to feel more supported in any other modicum of your life than you will feel here in your 2 years in the Wharton MBA. And that's our commitment to our students. And I think it's nice that you feel that, because I think that that reverberates across the community.
It really came through, you know, in both those conferences. So Wharton is, of course, also very committed to innovation. So the next question I would have is, what's new at Wharton?
I mean, the way I would answer it is like, how much time you got? There's a lot to do. That's important. Yeah, like the first two top line things I want to just throw out there, and there was a couple, you know, releases about these two buildings. We're making massive updates to the physical plant on campus, and I think that's huge. We're opening the Wharton Academic Research Building in the fall. It's actually right next to the admissions office, so anybody that comes into the admissions office, they can see it. Home of academic research, Wharton and Penn, and you know, in Philadelphia, we really want to be the home of, you know, really core business research, and we call it the WARB because everything at Philadelphia at Wharton is an acronym. So the Wharton Academic Research Building is new. Also in the spring of 2021, I believe, we are opening Tangen Hall, which is going to be the Center for Entrepreneurship at Wharton, and its entire building and ecosystem that will house kind of all of the resources in that space. And, you know, really the goal of that, and I've heard Dean Jeff Garrett say it really well, you know, we want to kind of catch up in the ecosystem of entrepreneurship, but then spring forward everybody, or spring past everybody else. And that building will be the hub for undergraduate and graduate level connection resources, innovation, AI, and all that stuff. So that is very exciting as well. There's a lot of new stuff going on at Wharton, specifically in kind of the future of finance space, innovation in finance. We just opened two new centers, the Harris Center for Alternative Investments and the Stevens Center for Innovation in Finance, you know, one focusing on financial technology and kind of innovation in that space, and then alternative investments, you know, in that realm as well. So that is very exciting. And I think the dean has really poised us to be moving forward into the right direction in finance over the next 10, 15 years, which is really exciting.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Now, one of the things that's new that is are the deferred admissions programs. Now, there's been tremendous growth in general in the MBA world with this whole deferred admissions concept, but you have two programs, right? You have the Moelis program, and you have the advanced, yeah, I guess it's the Moelis Advanced Access Program, and then just the Advanced Access Program. So can you tell us a little bit about those programs, what's the difference, et cetera?
Exceedingly reasonable question, and one that I'm very eager to dive into. Yes. So, you know, I really do think, you know, in my heart that this deferred entry programs, like this wave, is really where MBA programs need it to go. I feel really strongly in the idea that students don't feel like they could and can take risks between their undergraduate graduation and if they're eventually thinking about a business school application. I meet so many students, and I've met so many students over the last 8 years that say, you know, I really would have loved to start my own company or XYZ, but I was nervous because I knew I always wanted to go for a top MBA and I didn't want to take the risk. And so that's for us, the core driver of these programs. We want to lock in the talent early so they can go out and help the world. You know, we have a relationship with a bunch of companies we're trying to funnel our students to, just to make sure that they can make that impact between undergraduate graduation and coming back to business school. But let me tell you the difference between the programs. The Moelis Advanced Access Program was kicked off 2 years ago. So we've had two admitted cohorts for Moelis, and they are just Penn undergraduates. Now, an important distinction, it's not just Wharton undergraduates. It's actually undergraduates from all four undergraduate schools at the University of Pennsylvania. But specifically, we kept the program closer to home for 2 years. And then in the fall, I guess only about 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, we launched Advanced Access globally. And so now students from any undergraduate program in the world can apply through the Advanced Access program, gain entry to the Wharton MBA, go work for 2, 3, or 4 years, and then come back to the program. And so those are the differences between the programs.
Okay, great. For both programs, what role does what the students want to do during that 2, 3, 4 year period play? I mean, do you want to see students experimenting? What if they want to go work in investment banking or management? They have the more common, typical kinds of...
Right.
Yeah. Traditional. Thank you.
Yeah. I would think, you know, not I would think, I think, you know, we see actually a wide variety in that cohort. So we haven't admitted anybody nor seen any applications for the Advanced Access Program globally. So the only evaluation and selection we've done is for the Moelis Advanced Access Program. And I can say with that small cohort, we've seen students do both. We've seen students go into traditional banking and consulting, and we've seen students take more risks in terms of nonprofit and social impact and entrepreneurship. And so I would say, like, it depends on the cohort, but I would say going forward, we're literally, you know, it doesn't probably matter for us. We're looking for talent in any way that it comes, but it's more about what we want students to feel free to do post-graduation, not necessarily their first job. Because as we all know, you know, 2021 is a really difficult time. You know, our students are really talented. They find themselves sometimes in some of the top companies in the world. And then, you know, what if they don't like that work stream, that role, that function, that industry? We want to give them the experience in order to pivot away from that if they did not make the best choice coming out of undergrad.
How many people do you plan to admit to those programs? Or do you know?
Honestly, Lindsay, it depends. Yeah, no, it depends on talent. I mean, I don't think it would be ideologically correct of me to put a number on it before I see the school. And that's not, you know, jumping the question. That's genuinely true. So we'll see what comes through and then we'll see what we'll do.
Okay. All right. Let's go into a little bit of the application itself. Like, yeah. I think a lot of times applicants feel that they're asked to submit these elements because they're asked to submit these elements. You know, there's almost a certain random quality to it. In the end, I know when I talk to admissions directors, there's nothing random about it at all. It's all very purposeful. So what is the why behind the different elements? Let's start with the resume and work history.
That's interesting because I was talking to a group of students a couple years ago, and it was, you know, kind of like dating myself in the office, but it was about 2 or 3 years ago. And I said, and this kind of gets to the top line of your question, I said, you know, the most important components for the admissions committee at the Wharton MBA program are your transcript, your body of academic preparedness, and your resume, your career progression, what you've been doing with yourself post-graduation. And I said it, just a very normal comment, I thought. And you would have thought that I had insulted their family. And so for me, you know, I say that brief anecdote because the transcript and the resume, of course, are not random pieces of information I'm collecting. I think everybody can understand why I'm doing that. But this is why I say that, you know, essays and letters of recommendation, they're more a moment in time, a snapshot in your life. But really, the length and the depth and breadth of your life, your adult life, lives in those two documents, right? So when students ask me, and this kind of is a little bit aside of the question, but when students get admitted to Wharton and they say, thank you so much for admitting me, I genuinely, and for 15 years I've been in this business, and I said, I didn't admit you. I just happened to be in the chair. I wasn't there, you know, at midnight studying for organic chemistry your freshman year. I wasn't there when you were jostling for your first promotion and all the political hurdles that took. I wasn't there when you were, you know, stayed up to 2 o'clock in the morning to prep that presentation for the client. And so that is, you know, so self-directed, and that is so long. You know, essays are a moment in time, letters of recommendation are a moment in time, even interviews, which I'm happy to talk about, and I know we'll get into, are a moment in time. Are a moment in time, but those two documents, that's blood, sweat, and tears for 4 years of college and maybe a year of grad school and a couple years of work. And so, you know, that's why we require those. And that's the most important thing that we look at.
I think those documents also show your preparedness both for school and for the career after school.
Yeah. And so one of the things I'm proud that our office does, and I'm happy to get into this as well, is we're really starting, and probably about 5 years ago, started to really seriously track the outcomes of our students. And so, you know, we have a really robust feedback loop and mechanism and, you know, full-time data scientist who really looks at, you know, the student profiles on the inbound, whether it's not just GPA, that would be the easy way out. You know, GPA through career trajectory, progression, et cetera, and then even moments of kind of their community connection. And these three pieces in particular, how that translates into their time at the Wharton MBA, were they successful? And I'm not just talking about in the classroom. And so we've done all the infrastructure work for that. So now we're able to say, actually, this piece of the application is predictive of success in X arena. And we've really spent a lot of time in blood, sweat, and tears on that. And so that really helps us in terms of the application component. And I would love to impart to students that it's not random. It's very purposeful. And we don't want the process to feel more stressful than it is. And so everything we ask for, we need.
Okay, great. That was a great answer. Now let's touch on the essays.
Yeah.
There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that goes into the essays. It may not be over quite as long a time as a transcript or a resume, but a lot goes into that. Right. So Wharton has two required essays.
So I have a deep, deep passion for the evaluation of talent. I feel like that could be just like carved on my bed sheet. I think about that a lot. And so the essays are really kind of an extension of how do we use verbiage to evaluate talent. And so the first essay gets to that a little bit better than the second essay, which I will go into. The first essay on our books is, what do you want professionally from the Wharton MBA? And that's not a trick. It's been there for years. And we really want students to do a little bit of self-reflection about why they want to come get this degree. And for us, and I say this all the time to students, you know, in a certain level of the world, like you, your pathway is going to take you into an undergraduate institution. But to get an MBA, that's a choice. That's a moment in time, and that's a decision. I call it the pivot moment, or a series of pivot moments that took you, you know, to this place where you're sitting, you know, writing your essay. And so we really want students to explore that pivot moment in their essay, and kind of exploring that pivot moment actually unpacks the talent, time and treasure that they can deliver to the Wharton MBA. And we've consistently seen year over year that that essay and the way people write about themselves in it has been indicative of who is more successful in the program. Because if you spend more time and you're really thinking about, you know, the top three things that you want to get out of your 2 years in Philadelphia, that actually does translate to better success. And so that's why we keep that essay, again, very personal, purposeful. You know, the second essay was new last year, I believe. And that was a direct response to our students. You know, it was a risk. I will very much admit it was a risk coming off of our desks. And we did that specifically because in focus group, Linda, after focus group that we did with our students, they said they felt the MBA application process did not give them as many chances to explain their humanity as they needed, right? And so we reflected on that a lot. And the second essay is supposed to be just that. You know, the advice I give is close up.
Sorry. I just want to say that the second essay asks, describe an impactful experience or accomplishment that is not reflected elsewhere in your application. How will you use what you learned through that experience to contribute to the Wharton community? So we hadn't said what it was, so.
Oh, sorry. Yes, that was for the listeners. That'll be helpful context. So the reason we worded it like that is because we felt students were missing an avenue to explain their humanity, and we wanted to provide them one. And so, you know, that essay doesn't have to be super formal, but my advice is close the application, walk away. If you feel like there's a story behind that second promotion that you really need to explain in order for somebody to understand who you are, that's where you put it. And that's why we have it, even though it was a risk to go out with two essays. We want to get to know our students, and I know that sounds like what everybody says, but it's really true. And the last thing I'll say on this is the worst thing that can happen to me as an evaluator is when you close the application and you say, I don't know enough about that person. And I've experienced firsthand that second essay helps me with that problem.
You want to feel like you're meeting somebody through the
I do.
Essays and the application as a whole, but the essays also. And are
Absolutely.
You okay? You mentioned like a professional challenge and getting a second promotion, but are you also interested, let's say, in a personal challenge or a non-professional challenge?
Yes, yes, and yes, all of it, right? I'm interested in an academic challenge, a family challenge, a dog walking challenge. I'm interested in anything that defines you.
Okay. And what about the professional recommendations? And Wharton's are a little different than the typical.
Yeah. And that's where we met, right? Giving
right,
a presentation
exactly,
on that.
Exactly.
Yes.
Oh, you have a good memory. Okay.
Yes. So I really believe in creating the correct evaluative levers in order to assess talent. And so 3 years ago, we stepped back and looked at our letter of recommendation format. And honestly, Linda, I've been evaluating applications for 15 years. I've tens of thousands of them through my brain. And the one thing that kept coming back to me was, you know, and you know, maybe other folks in my shoes don't agree, and that's fine. I think we can all have polite disagreement on the topic, but most recommendations to business school and many application schemas have a rubric at the top of the letter of recommendation form. And I know as an evaluator that, and I interviewed letter of recommendation writers, hundreds of them in order to do this, surveys and personal conversations. And they said kind of resoundingly, there was no motivation for me not to fill out the right side of the rubric. And as an evaluator, I felt that. Every time you would open an application, Linda, everybody would check top 1%, top 5%. So if everybody was topping that, if somebody was honest and said, this person's top 15% in my career, that suddenly looks like a blight. And so when you have unusable evaluative data at scale, the whole thing is a waste of time. And so that is why we implemented the recommenders to pick an adjective or a set of adjectives, because there has been some personality traits that are predictive of success. And I've just mentioned we're doing a lot of kind of outcome-based testing, and that's going to help us do that. And so if I had an evaluative measure that I knew at scale wasn't doing anything, I wanted to input something else in there. And that's really the core of that.
Great. And I believe when we did meet cross-continentally, my comment when you were explaining this change at the time, it was about 3 years ago. My comment was, it's not really a recommendation. It's more of an introduction or evaluation. So the title recommendation is almost a misnomer, and yeah. It encourages everybody to say top 1%, top 5%.
Well, I think the word recommendation in and of itself tells you the problem with it. You're never getting negative praise, right? And so, like, just imagine, you know, that side of the bell curve over and over and over again, you realize how useless pieces of that evaluative puzzle are. And so, you know, I think also the fact that I answered the question like that is another kind of nod to how we think of things in our office, and kind of the bedrock of our culture. And the bedrock of all our culture exists in a sentence called read to admit, which means, and I've said this many times publicly, you know, every time we're looking at an application, Linda, we're looking for reasons to admit the student and not for reasons to deny the student. And people outside of my chair probably wouldn't understand the distinction. But once you decide that that's the bedrock of how you make decisions, the whole world opens up, because you're really just looking for positive pieces. So I remember that comment, and I remember really thinking about, what if I rename these, you know, profiles, like your, you know, candidate profile or something. And, you know, sometimes the business handcuffs you in certain ways. So that's not the hill I decided to die on that particular year. But I think that's totally right for discussion, because when you look at everything through a positive lens, the whole world shifts.
Okay, well, that's a great answer also. Now let's get to the interview, right? And I want to get back to the whole read to admit comment, but a little bit later. Wharton has its TBD, team-based discussion, and the individual interview. How do they fit into the mix?
I love your question. It was more like, you have this, discuss. That was kind of like hidden in your question, just discuss. Well, they're actually going on right now.
I know.
I'm a couple blocks away from our office right now, but they're going on right now. It's the second day of round one team-based discussions. We launched the team-based discussion in 2012, and I actually was part of the first round of it. I conducted kind of the first formal round. We did kind of a pilot the year before. And the reason we did it is a couple of reasons. And so now it's years into the team-based discussion, a lot of data. We're Wharton, so of course we're looking at kind of like the outcome success metrics, how students who do well in the team-based discussion do well in the program, et cetera. And so the reason we do it is kind of twofold. One, there's a lot of evidence and a lot of academics, if you just do a quick Google on it, that behavioral interviews are actually not predictive of success at all. They can be massively biased. Extroverts rather than introverts tend to shine. And at scale, when we're trying to evaluate and select for talent among thousands of interviewees, we just determined in our own personal case study that the behavioral interview method wasn't going to work for us. And so that's why we made that decision. Second reason is Wharton is, in essence, a team-based learning environment. There was a survey done 2 years ago on campus that our students are in about 17 different teams throughout their 2 years in the program. And so if we have a team-based ecosystem, why don't we do a team-based inbound? And so those are the kind of the two main cores as to why we run a team-based discussion. And it's been resoundingly successful. This was also a risk in 2012 to push this out into the world. And I think kind of the stress level, I hope, has dissipated around it. You know, I just greeted the 52 students that were on campus today. And I said, you know, our main goal for all of you is to make sure that you feel like you're having the best day of your lives. I really don't feel that there should be undue stress put on business school candidates through the interview process. And so that's kind of our whole lens into this. The last thing that I will say about the team-based discussion is that it's not a binary decision post team-based discussion. What I mean by that is it's not like they hit the interview hurdle and then they either do really well and gain admission or do poorly and unfortunately are denied. We feel like it is testing and evaluating a piece and component of who you will be in business school that is different than your application, but it's not the more important thing or less important thing, right?
So it's an element.
Sometimes we have students, right? We have students who have really, really strong applications, do marginally in the team-based discussion, and are very easy admitted students. Alternatively, we have students that have marginal applications, but rocket in the team-based discussion and super easy admits, right? Because it's evaluating something different. And that's kind of how we run the admissions committee post team-based discussion.
And that also, by the way, fits in, and I do want to ask one last question about the individual component, but what you're saying is, which I knew you would say, is that each element serves a different function and reveals something a little different about the applicant. Okay, so the team-based discussion serves them in a group setting. The essays have a different function. The resume and the transcript show performance over time and likelihood of success in the future. The professional evaluations or profiles, whatever we want to call them, give a third-party perspective on one's character and abilities. Right. So that's kind of what I was hoping was going to come out of this question. And it is. I just want to go back one little element, and that is the individual interview component of the interview at Wharton.
Yep.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for us, I would say like the team-based discussion exercise in and of itself is the most important component of what you're coming there to do. But the team-based discussion absolutely factors in. And in that way, we do find out more about your candidacy. We find out your experience through the exercise, why you acted like you did, if this is how you typically act. I mean, here's an anecdote. I interviewed a student, I mean, it must have been years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And the way he conducted himself through the team-based discussion is he sat back more and he was more a conversation facilitator. And it was just a very well done and interesting way to approach it. And so I asked him about that. And I said, you know, that we do blind interviews, and we do blind interviews because we feel like different evaluators with different touch points decreases bias and noise on decisions. And so we feel pretty strongly in that, and we can get into that later. So I hadn't read his application, but I was looking at his resume just very quickly. And I said, you know, that was just a very interesting, well done way to approach that. And he said, well, I own my own company. It's a small company. We only have 8 employees. And that's how I like to run our staff meetings. I like to kind of sit back, put questions around the table, and see kind of how my employees navigate to solve problems. And I said, that makes total sense. And so that's kind of what that one-on-one can produce. And that's the type of thing it typically does produce. And that's why it's successful for us.
Okay. So it's not really so much to learn more about them as an individual as a follow-up to the TBD and kind of get reactions on that. Is that correct?
It can be. I mean, I think it depends on, you know, how quickly each person talks. I mean, like, you know, we try to make the experience the same, you know, across every candidate. It's, it's difficult to do that. So I think it depends on kind of where the interview takes itself. Sometimes it's more on the resume and kind of why Wharton, and sometimes it's more on the exercise itself.
Okay. Now let's move on. What, you've been doing this for a while. You've talked about 10, 15 years in admissions. What do you look for or emphasize more now than you did, let's say, 3 or 7 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, so I'm going to go back to us tracking outcomes a little bit and really trying to follow our students through the program and then follow them post-program. And so this is something we started about 5 years ago. So I have kind of, 5 years of data to look at. And so a couple things that live in that. One, and I'd be very interested, I mean, I could talk shop with other admissions professionals for way too many hours. And so this is questions I have asked of peers and just other admissions people. If anybody else is tracking outcomes, because to me, it's super important. It's something that I'm so happy we decided to do, because as admissions professionals, you know, one thing is that you bring all biases to the table. And I think that's something that you just have to put out there and understand that. And so I put that out there and I tell that to everybody that works in our office. And in saying that, you kind of disarm yourself and saying, like, I know that I have biases and I'm going to put them as far away as I possibly can. I say all of that in the case where admissions people tend to say, you know, this type of person will do well at Wharton, whether it's in their career or in the classroom. But now I don't have to guess. I know. Now, I'm not saying that's going to drastically change on 100% scale who we're admitting, but it helps around the margins, right? Like, so instead of sticking to hard and fast GMAT scores, you can say, like, listen, I know that has no bearing on how students do here. And so I would say the types of students we're able to admit because of the Outcomes Project has vastly increased, which is really exciting for us. because we now know we don't have to fear and or guess if the students are going to do well or not well in the classroom or well or not well within their kind of job search. And so the criteria we use to admit students has opened up, and that's changed, which I think is really, really nice. And also the market's changed. I mean, so I've been sitting in the Wharton Admissions Committee for 8 years, and the employers who come to campus are vastly different. You know, the number one employer was Amazon last year. And so kind of like populating that ecosystem is a change from 2012 when I got there. And so, you know, that's something we pay attention to. Your question was how we've started looking at different things,
what
or how
we've
changed. What have
you started to emphasize more? What are you seeking more in applicants?
Yeah. So, and someone asked me that a similar question, but like maybe just right of it the other day. And they said, you know, what's the Wharton admissions office looking for? And I said, you know, I know that one of my peers who I really respect and like answers leadership. And I was like, I actually think that's a good answer. I was like, I think that's a great answer for that context. I was like, however, like that's not my answer. One, because I'm not going to steal that person's answer, but that's genuinely not true for my institution. And I, you know, my answer is, you know, Wharton students, and I was just meeting with an employer this morning, a CEO of a big company, and she said, you know, we love the Wharton MBAs in our shop because they're innovative and they roll up the sleeves and they're gutsy. And so I feel like the hallmark of a Wharton student is someone who's a dual threat, someone that wants to manage and lead an organization, but also wants to roll up their sleeves, get their hands dirty, understand the guts of a marketing, program or model. And so those are the types of students we're looking to admit through the process, because we feel like that's more tactile and more kind of easy to suss out in an evaluative sense when they're 26 to 35 years old, 25 to 35 plus.
Got it. And this, I think, all kind of ties into the next question. You're looking for, I guess, end results. You have results-based data, so that you can broaden the applicant pool you read to admit. At the same time, if I look at the class profile for the class of 2021, the overall GMAT range was 540 to 790. The mean GMAT was 732. The average GPA for students on the 4.0 system was 3.6. I know you know this data, but the listeners don't. And especially, especially in the GMAT, that's a pretty wide range. So what would... You know, what do you look for besides admission stats, and how does one, you know, what would compensate for below average stats? Because obviously people looking at that stats, and let's say they have a 690 or a 700 or a 650, they're going to be thinking, gee, do I even have a chance? Does it pay for me to apply? I get asked this question all the time.
Right. And actually, so one of the other questions you had given me, maybe we'll get to it, is like one of the things, what do you hope to accomplish? And that's one of the things I hope to accomplish, is like be more transparent through our process. We'll talk about that, and kind of be more open about kind of that academic range that it would take proverbially to get into the Wharton MBA. So there's a lot of avenues for that, for an answer to this, Linda, but I'm going to try to be succinct. But I will start with the fact that from our data and from talking to the GMAT people, we have seen an inflation in overall average GMAT scores.
Sure.
And so that's something we've talked to them about. We said, you know, every GMAT score we get is really high. Obviously, it's a self-selecting pool. But then we look at the broader landscape, and we say that overall, like globally, GMAT scores are ratcheting up. And so I say all of that in the context too. It's not that we're cherry picking higher GMAT scores than we were 8 to 10 years ago. I would say the average is increasing from our experience in our own pool, but then also what we've done to talk to the GMAT Corporation. So I will say that. Second thing is, you know, and I always go back to my experience in undergraduate admissions here at the University of Pennsylvania. And I say consistently, you know, they're 18 years old. The academic background is much more important in determining admission for those students than it is in the Wharton MBA. It's still important, and I'll unpack a little bit what I'm saying. But there's less runway, and so there's less room for mistakes in the academic arena in the undergrad context. And so the answer for me always in the undergraduate context is, you know, should I take the honors class and get an A or the AP class and get a B? And my answer is, and you're not going to like this answer, folks, is you have to get an A in the AP class, right? The same situation does not manifest itself in the Wharton MBA. The main question we ask ourselves is, can this student handle the curriculum? And then the difference between a B plus and a B minus in statistics is not going to cross our radar. We want to determine if they can handle the curriculum, will excel and thrive. We can't, you know, throw somebody into the deep end of the pool. But then we look at the rest of the tail of their whole career, right? 5 years working, 6 years working. You know, sometimes that means more to us than the B minus in statistics. And so that's how a person with the B minus in statistics, a couple C's, folks that do get admitted to the program excel in the admissions process because they've done so much post that experience to really shine. And it would be foolish of us to not admit students that have a C in statistics yet have been really excelling in their career. It would be unwise. And so we don't do that. And so that's how it feels different. And that's kind of what we're focusing on.
All right. And what about the low GMAT? I mean, one or two low grades, especially early in the college career, I think it's my impression is that it's easier to forgive, if you will, or look beyond. Yeah. But the low GMAT, which is current and is supposed to be predictive of success in business school, yet you read to
a couple
admit.
Of things. You do read to admit. So that's how I answer that question always. So if you ever talk to a student that I've talked to, genuinely, that's how I answer the question. They'll say, I have a low GMAT. First of all, what is low? Which is a totally different answer. But what is low? Okay, fine. But the second is, well, how did you do in undergrad or graduate school? And if they say I did well, I'm like, okay, well, then that's what you needed to determine that you could handle the curriculum, right? Under a read to admit model, you don't have to be perfect in everything. You have to be strong and, you know, not bottom of the barrel in everything else, right? And so, you know, that's why it's honestly so much more fun for me at the MBA level, because you see students who have different, you know, pieces of their career, right? And so that's why I answer the question, low-ish GMAT score, strong GPA, you've evidenced it, it's fine, it's over. And under a read-to-admit model, that's enough.
Got it. Now, in a recent interview that I saw online, you said, and you talked about earlier in this interview, you talked about the read-to-admit, and you said in this interview online, which you're probably very familiar with, what we're fundamentally is a school, and we're trying to enroll people that we think will grow the most from this program, not the people that were perfect coming in. Now, you get lots of applications from people who can grow in the Wharton program and who are admissible. Probably more people fit into these categories than don't in terms of your applicant pool. How do you weigh it down?
Yeah, so I feel like that question's hard to answer in this setting because one, it like opens up our whole process, which I want to be able to open up some of it, but I can't open up all of it. And then it gets to, you know, students come to me. I always like to answer questions like I answer them. What's that?
They want a formula. They want
right.
a formula.
Well, no, I always like to answer questions the way I would answer them to a student in the back of the pen club when we do an information session, right? Okay. And for us, it's kind of like that Venn diagram, right? You're like, you just said like, who are admissible, who can grow through the program, right? But like the Venn diagram there is like, but what will they give to the program? And how much can we really help them through the program is like the middle of that Venn diagram, which is what I tend to focus on, right? So there's a lot of students that need to grow, but can I really help you? You know, I want to see you graduate and be great for the school, right? So you can probably grow, but can I help you as much as other students, right? And so that's like a way we start to whittle it down. And also, what can you give back to us? And that's, you know, I think a really important kind of feedback loop.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you. Now, I did want to ask you, what do you want to accomplish as Director of Admissions at Wharton?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is it's been such a wild ride, complete honor, complete privilege, you know, but two things that jump out to me that I would love to accomplish while I'm in this chair. One is to be more transparent about our process, turn the lights on a little bit. You know, one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast, Linda, and I've done others, and we're producing blogs and we're producing articles and we're producing webinars is, you know, I did a 1-hour webinar, you know, soup, which maybe you've seen, soup to nuts, about, you know, how you click drop down number one all the way through tips on essays with a slide. You know, I don't want this process to feel at the height of stress. And so that's something that I'm really kind of working on within our shop, is to turn the lights on and be more transparent as a process. And so that's something that I'll continue to do. And kind of in that vein, but like slightly to the right of it, is I really want to start to democratize the information about admissions that flows to applicants. Right now, I find that, you know, certain students, you know, coming from higher socioeconomic statuses have more access to resources that will help them. And I would love to democratize that information. And that goes hand in hand with being more transparent about the process. And so that's kind of something I have our whole shop working on in terms of an external POV. And then kind of internally for me, refining and continuing to refine the mechanisms on how we evaluate and select for talent. You know, I take that really seriously, and I feel, you know, we don't exist just to admit students and deny students. We exist to kind of really try to unpack at scale with thousands of students a year, you know, the talent that can grow here. And that takes a lot of TLC and a lot of kid glove care. And that's what I try to do on the inbound or on the internal side.
Great. What aspect of the admissions process do you believe that applicants underestimate the most?
Yeah, I was thinking about this one, Linda. That's tough. I think it's very, very personal. But, you know, on the macro, I think that maybe students underestimate the entire process. And I'll tell you why that's my answer.
Okay.
One of the other things I could have answered
in
the last question on. What's
that? That was an interesting response, yeah.
Yes, it's the entire process. And this is something that I could have used as an answer to the last question. What do you hope to accomplish? One of the things that I would really love to accomplish in my chair, and it's a lofty goal, but it's to look at the whole system. Look at the whole system and, you know, across, let's just say, even the top schools right now. How do I make the process easier for candidates to go through the business school application process? It is not interesting to me to hear how arduous it is. That makes me feel like we are not doing a service to students when we are a school. That's what we should be doing, a service to students. And so what I would be interested in is I know that the process is not easy, and I think people underestimate the time it takes to apply to 2, 3, 4 schools, because one school has a team-based discussion, one school has a video interview, one school has a post-interview write-up, 2 essays, 3 essays. So I know that so far in my career, I haven't been the most helpful to that goal. But I think going forward, you know, where I have my eyes now is how do we make the entire system a little bit more student friendly, and therefore students don't have to underestimate or overestimate because they know the system is trying to help them. And so that is kind of where my head is at, to help students, because I don't want them to have to estimate or underestimate the process at all. I want to make less barriers to entry for talented students to come into MBAs globally.
Okay. How would you respond to an applicant who says, I really want to apply, but I'm concerned about graduating into a recession?
That is such a good question. So I'm going to paraphrase a managing director at a big bank that I was talking to last Monday when I was thinking about this question. And he, I you know, I met him. I was there recruiting the candidates in New York on Monday afternoon. And he sidelined me in the hallway, you know, before the conference room. And he said, I'm a business school grad, and I feel so strongly about this. And, you know, students will talk about opportunity costs. And whenever anybody comes into my office and starts talking about opportunity costs, I say, shut up. Don't talk to me about opportunity costs. This is an investment in self. This is the best investment you'll make. I'd go back and pay the tuition 3 times over with everything that I learned. And I thought that was just such an interesting point of view. And he went on to say, you know, for students that are applying to top MBA programs, I thought it was very astutely said. He said, you know, you are cursed with a strong work ethic. You are likely not going to stop working, and your work career will take you for the next 40 years. So when you think about what you want to do over the next 40 years and who you want to be within the career landscape in 40 years, the best investment in self is an MBA. And that's what he said over and over again. And so whether it's into a recession or not into a recession, I feel like that piece of advice resounds. So recessions don't last for 40 years. And so I think, you know, when you think about kind of a 40-year career ROI, kind of that's what I come back to in terms of the MBA degree, which is unique in that way. And so the MBA is special.
Okay, great answer. What would you have liked me to ask you?
Another good question. I like to talk about, I like to talk about kind of our passion for, you know, fair and accurate evaluation and selection of candidates. I love to talk about all of the work we do in reducing bias and reducing noise in admissions decisions. That stuff I could talk about for hours. And frankly, I do both socially and professionally. So that's very exciting to me. So that stuff I'd love to talk about. But I also would love to talk about kind of the misconceptions about Wharton. I think that's something
Go
that
ahead.
I hear all the time. Yeah.
What are some of the misconceptions about Wharton?
Yes. So, you know, for me, so the interview that you referenced earlier in this interview was an interview I did with Eddie Banks Crossan, our director of student life. And I can't remember if this came up in that conversation, but he and I talk all the time that students come to Wharton, you know, whether it's for welcome weekend or a visit day or the first day of school, and they say, Linda, consistently, I had no idea that this place felt like this. I didn't know that this was the Wharton culture. I'm really surprised by the passion and the energy and the humility, and I'm really surprised by Philadelphia. And Eddie keeps saying, our director of student life, he goes, I love when students say that to me because we get to change their minds. And I say, I hate when students say that to me because it makes me feel like I didn't do my job on the inbound. So for me, I think the misconception is like what Wharton actually is, what our bedrock culture is, what we feel like, who we are. I think people think we're super competitive. We're super collaborative. I think people think Wharton students are, you know, cutthroat, and they're not. I think people think Philadelphia is a detriment to the program, and it is absolutely a net positive to the program. And so it's the misinterpretation of 30 years of Wharton culture as, you know, appropriating as what we are now. And I've traveled all around the world in the last almost 15 years talking about, you know, University of Pennsylvania and the Wharton MBA. And I've said, you know, you can't really understand it until you come to campus, which is a really lame argument when you're sitting in Bangalore. But really, it's very difficult to communicate the culture sitting in this conference room, sitting in Bangalore. And so I just encourage people to come because they come on campus and they say, this is not what I thought this was. And I think that turns heads. And so that's something that I always love to talk about. Just the misconceptions. And the misconceptions are Philadelphia, competitive, not humble, et cetera. They all live in that world.
When I was dating my husband, I was also applying to MBA programs. And I applied to Wharton, and I was accepted with a small scholarship. And we were dating very seriously. And I went to him very excited, and my then boyfriend, and I said, oh, I got in. I got into Wharton. I got a small scholarship, and we were in L.A. And okay. He said, really? He said, well, you wouldn't want to go to Wharton. I said, why wouldn't I want to go to Wharton? He said, Philadelphia is ugly. I said, have you ever been to Philadelphia? He was from New York. I said, have you been? No, I've never been there. So.
And I'm from D.C., but I feel like I stated, like my board of tourism soapbox. So, yeah.
Right. All right. So then years later, we were actually visiting somebody in D.C. and we were driving up, I think, to Philadelphia to visit Wharton. And the southern entry to Philadelphia is not a very pretty entry. So he basically said, you see, Linda, you see, I told you it was ugly. And then I went to the AGAC conference at Wharton. It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful city.
Mm-hmm. And getting more and more beautiful every year. I mean, this place has vastly changed. I've lived here for almost 20 years, and it's been unbelievably changed in 20 years. So, yeah, Philadelphia. I mean, people think it's the detriment. It's literally the exact opposite.
It, and where you're located is also beautiful. But, no, it was that was my view of – that was just – anyways, he was having some commitment problems. He got over it.
Clearly.
All right, Blair, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. You've been extremely generous with your time. Where can listeners and potential applicants learn more about the Wharton MBA program?
Absolutely. So we have a super robust website, and I will call you to two specific pages on that website. So wharton.upenn.edu, the tab is admissions, two specific moments in time. There are a very new and robust, what we call admissions fellows, 55 per current students that you can connect with to hear about the Wharton program. It's searchable by keyword. It's searchable so you can search it by undergrad institution or company or space. And so if you want to talk to somebody who went to Duke and works in technology, you can do that. So go check out
our alumni as well as current students?
Just 55 current students that are paid and on our payroll to take your questions. So please reach out to them. Yes, so it's 55 students on our payroll. That's something else I'm trying to do in my chair, Linda, is promote that program a little bit more. And then the second is I want to call attention to the 1-hour webinar I did on admissions. Okay. And so again, democratizing the information. It's 1 hour long, everything from the first click down to, you know, what program you apply to, all the way through interview, and that's available on our website and also the Wharton YouTube channel. So both things I would love for you to check out.
We'll include links in the show notes at exhibit.com/342 to the sites that Blair just mentioned, as well as to related articles and show notes. Check them all out. They are all linked to from exhibit.com/342. And a final reminder. First of all, Blair mentioned a webinar that she gave that you should see. You definitely should see it. But I also gave a webinar on getting accepted to Wharton. And if you haven't yet seen Accepted's Get Accepted to Wharton webinar, go directly to exhibit.com/342webinar and view it. Listener, I want to thank you too for joining Blair Mannix and me for our 342nd episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any future shows, be they with admissions directors, professors, current students, test prep pros, or alumni doing great things. Thanks again for coming. This is Admissions Trade Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.